David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 410. I'm your host, Steve Raker, pounding sand in the God Quarry and forging it into my very own comic book bunker. With me are abstract demigod entities WWX Kevin and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit.
I'm holding my cosmic cube.
Wow, I've been promoted.
Marvel Noise is a semi-monthly podcast sponsored by nobody. You can find, stream, and download episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com or, you know, use the podcast catching software of your choice. Listen to other fine podcasts from our facilitators, the Deliberate Noise Network. That includes Indie Comic Book Noise, where Andrew, Kevin, Phil, and sometimes I talk indie comics. And we've got Facebook and Twitter pages for new episode announcements, images, and feedback. This episode, we've got a giant-sized Recent Reads roundtable. But before we kick up our feet and get that rolling, I'm going to first dive into a Bronze Age binge of seven seemingly unrelated books grouped together this episode because, well... they're all episodes where the fill-in on art was Jim Starlin as the guest penciler.
And sometimes he was the best part of the issue.
So, Kevin, how are we going to go through these?
We got to do it in chronological order.
That's right. That's how we do things. That's our offering to Lord Chaos. I mean, to Lord Kronos. Chaos?
I'm looking forward to Fangor myself.
Well, wait no further, because we start with Iron Man number 56 from November 1972 with a Jim Starlin, Joe Sinnott cover. This is the issue after Thanos was introduced.
It's so weird. He goes from fighting Thanos to roller skating right in the next issue.
I mean, that's pretty cool, though, right? Starlin brings back Shellhead's roller skates, and he's just, like, skating through Midtown Manhattan traffic. Starlin did the plot and pencils, and Steve Gerber provided the script, and Mike Esposito the inks.
Steve Gerber, ever my nemesis.
I love the title, too. Rasputin's Revenge.
Iron Man always presents...
Did you not think of Gargamel when you saw this guy?
Totally.
I can see it. I mean, the little guy he summons is blue, so that makes sense. I always feel like Iron Man, it's a hard... Like, the original Kirby, okay, it's clearly a guy in, like, a futuristic spacesuit, diving suit with all the weapons. The Kirby redesigns, but it's how much iron and how much, like, flexible... Starlin really goes for a very contoured suit.
Yep.
And I guess it may be a little too contoured for my taste. I think I'm more in the, it's flexible, but not showing every crease and wrinkle and maybe a little more iron, a little less man in the design. I mean, it's not bad. It's just my preference for that is to go where it's clearly metallic bits, even though they are somewhat contoured.
Yeah, it's not like his skin, but I guess he was one day he was maybe up late drinking, and he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna meld some abs into this armor," and it's like, "Okay, sure." It's
well, that's why he had to have a 6 martini lunch because he couldn't eat any food and still fit in the armor. So he...
That's Bronze Age Iron Man, though. You know, the gold stuff was like liquid metal on him, and he had abs. And sometimes it looked like those little knobs were like nipples.
Yes. The only time you're allowed to have nipples in the 70s.
So why Iron Man skating through Midtown Manhattan traffic as he's headed to Avengers Mansion to tell everyone about this Thanos guy? Like, people should probably know, right? But nobody's home except Jarvis, so he decides to take a walk in the park as Tony Stark.
Forget Thanos, Steve. You should get as many copies of this for the first appearance of Rasputin, a.k.a. Gargamel. You can probably corner the market on it.
Well, that's in the park. He comes across this seemingly nutty street doomsday philosopher guy calling himself Rasputin, high priest of Tavi, the angel of death. And, he's Gargamel, but he's also a pretty kind of cool design because he's like a hairless Uncle Creepy in like a monk robe, and he's got a cool staff. There's a unveiling ceremony in the park for a new Fievel Fuvnik sculpture.
This is so bizarre, like this turn of events. I was trying to figure this out, and it's just you just have to go with it, I guess.
So, Kevin, when are they announcing the Marvel Legends of Rasputin here figure? He seems ripe for a little plastic doll.
Or Fievel.
I mean, we're not quite there yet.
Rasputin comes and disrupts this unveiling ceremony, or at least the setup for it, and he breaks a camera while he's like shouting obscenities, and then splits. He uses his staff and jams it into the camera, and it like sparks and stuff. Then we get Shunned Rasputin's origin story.
Yeah.
Which is like deep, like Starlin's gone deep into this guy.
I know. I'm like, what is
that? He discovers and pursues the occult and everything. And sure enough, when you know it, breaking this camera shocked his homemade Tavi staff into becoming the real deal. So now he's got like the power.
So that's how they did it in the old days, Steve. The druids found ancient cameras to jam their staves into.
He goes back to the unveiling in the park there. I mean, the statue is this horrid monster.
So this is what the evil of humanity looks like? This monster that wants to fight you?
Well,
this is what New York City spent $40,000
on. Yeah, apparently.
that I'm not surprised. But Rasputin uses his now real Tavi staff to bring the statue to life, like with the essence of Tavi. And Tony has to change to Iron Man now that his stroll in the park is, you know, dare I say, become no stroll in the park. And sometimes I amuse myself. Fangor, this statue, he even talks, right? So he can, like, have a back and forth with Iron Man while they're fighting, which adds a delightful element to the proceedings. And it's 8 pages of fighting. It's action-packed.
Finally, the monster has a good maniacal look. Like, when he comes to life, I like that they give him, you know, his eyes get colored, so he has the white part of the eyes and everything. I think they might have kept him more statue-like, but that's fine. It makes him a real legit monster, you know, not just a bunch of rocks.
I mean, the splash page definitely looks like something out of those Marvel monster comics.
During the battle, Rasputin's staff breaks, which takes away any hope of him thinking that he's going to be controlling this Fangor. So he hightails it out of there, but gets hit by a police car like the second he steps out of the park.
What cruel fate.
And the officer just left a safe driving course where he was the instructor too. How embarrassing. The timing of it and his crumpled body laying there is pretty good comic relief, and the timing was done well. Iron Man ultimately defeats Fangor by, like, Cairo freezing him after he was already wet from chasing him through a pond, and then he shatters him.
They always used to throw in, I missed the old, not just the roller skates, but the transistor dialogue.
Sure.
They always talked about diodes and transistors, and I'm no engineering guy, so maybe they really work like that, but I always appreciated their attempts to sprinkle in engineering language.
Sometimes he'd have to use his hip like plate to like charge up, right? Like it's a big
well, his heart,
USB.
Steve, his heart.
I was joking with Andrew about comparing this issue to 8-Ball, and 8-Ball is probably better than this issue.
Oh, boo.
Don't take offense. Kevin's actually a pretty big fan of 8-Ball. 3 out of 5 stars. So
the issue ends with Rasputin drinking in a bar, talking to someone, you know, like, you probably don't even believe in magic. But the someone is revealed to be Doctor Strange, who smiles, pays his bill, and kind of offers the guy some encouraging advice on his way out the door.
I like how Doctor Strange is wearing his full Doctor Strange garb. Like, he didn't change into regular clothes. You want to keep your, you know, cloak and all that other. You never know when suddenly you're going to be called to fight some statue that came to life and attacked people in the park.
Speaking of Doctor Strange, the next issue is Marvel Premiere number 8. From February 1973, featuring Doctor Strange, which I
you
think...
know, I was going to ask us to read a sequence of these issues at one point, because I was kind of looking for the Kulin, is it Kulin? Not Kulin Goth. What's his name?
Shuma?
The dude. The...
Shuma Gorath?
Yeah, him.
I think this
but
one
I,
has...
I kept on unraveling. Like, I thought, oh, you only have to read one issue, two issues, and then...
Yeah, no,
the whole thing.
It was... Because it went between writers, and as they handed it off between writers, like, that background thing sort of was always there, but it took a while for them to finally address it, rather than, you know, each writer had their own story they wanted to tell, too, or own fill-in stories. But I think this one really has a great Jim Starlin, Tom Palmer cover. Strange is standing in front of a crypt on what, I mean, it looks like to be some planetoid, because it's got like the cosmos behind him in the sky, and there's this gargoyle demon thing on top about to like jump scare the doc. It's just oozing with Starlin-esque elements.
Yeah, this one I also liked it because, look, in 1973 it wouldn't have meant anything. You know, I couldn't read back then, but I mean, when you think Gardner Fox wrote this, you kind of think about how comics haven't been around for that long in the scheme of things. Like Gardner Fox, he's a big wheel in comic history.
Sure.
And I never knew he wrote a bunch of Marvel, but you know, I think of him as the DC guy.
Yeah,
in fact, he goes back to long enough that he might have rubbed elbows, metaphorically speaking. Because I know a lot of the DC guys came out of sci-fi, so he might have known, like, the Weird Tales crew. And even though they're clearly ripping off Lovecraft and those guys, like, he might have actually exchanged letters or been to things with it. You know what I mean?
For sure.
What a crazy link to all this. And I do like how they credit Howard, who...
Yes.
For those that don't know, the Lovecraft thing, they basically all just built on each other. And so they would make up fake characters that would appear in each other's stories. It's kind of the first continuity thing.
Yep.
So Howard, Lovecraft did a lot of the main architecture, but also Clark Ashton Smith threw in Robert Block. In fact, sometimes they'd put each other, Block and Lovecraft wrote each other into a connected two stories, where in each one they kill the other one off. And they're both like writers and this, like, they're thin veiled. So it was a fun kind of shared universe. But I like how Cthulhos is close to Cthulhu. Like,
yeah.
Spitting distance, so we get it. But anyways, that's a sort of related background, but it just reminded me, like, this stuff isn't that old in the scheme of things. You think of that stuff as a million years ago, but
didn't
Gardner Fox,
I don't,
man,
didn't he like write world. The early like JLA appearances and stuff, like,
yeah,
maybe,
I think
like,
he was
like the first, right?
Yeah, I think he was the like Silver Age dude, and I'm like, holy crap, here I am reading him taking on Doctor Strange, ripping off all the Weird Tales guys and some.
But
I thought this one was very pretty too.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Lots of detail. They really went all out throwing in busy to a good effect panels. You know, we're not that far. We're oftentimes we have eras of not a lot of background in panels. Well, kids, you get your money's worth. And this is no like Photoshop backgrounds. These are maybe you can get some tone or something, but this is hard elbow grease by the team to fill up. And it gives it a lush, to me, a very lush, cool background. And they went all out leaning into classic design with Clea with the goofy hair in the front and everything. And that's how I like it, when she's kind of silly and everything. And I know it's silly, but it works for me too. Plus, they really missed one chance though, Steve. I'm sure you thought of this as well. When the lightning strikes the tower and the sound effect guy puts Baroom, I'm like, oh, he could have put Barzoom. And had a secret John Carter tie-in.
Yeah, but everyone would have. John Carter was super popular back then, right? So everyone would have. Too obvious. It the backgrounds are so lush, it took two inkers. Right? It's written by Gardner Fox with art by Jim Starlin and Frank Giacoa and Dave Hunt. It's The Doom That Bloomed on Cthulhos, another great title. The issue opens with Strange, Wong, Clea, and the couple that own a haunted castle, the Witch House. They're being attacked by, like, furniture, appliances, and slime. It was the cliffhanger from issue 7. So Strange fights their way out and then raises the place to dust. He's like, see you later, Witch House. Poof.
Well, you don't want any dreams in the Witch House. See, I worked in that Lovecraft title, Steve.
Then Strange travels to Stonehenge alone to stop the rise of Shuma-Gorath. And I love how Starlin renders Strange's arms, like, as just the gloves sticking out of the big, floofy, like, balloons of his silk sleeves, you know? It's very, very Ditko-esque.
So not Shub-Niggurath.
But I don't want to be a pirate. It has a little bit of that look, too.
I keep thinking of the other names. That one's the closest, I feel. That might be closer than Cthulhos or whatever.
I think you've drinking the Lovecraft Kool-Aid.
I love that stuff. And I do like that we see one of his sort of typical demon guys, because I feel like the ab rib cage thing is a particular where you really see the pronounced rib cage and the muscles underneath. I feel like that's like a Starlin kind of monster character design.
Yeah. And at Stonehenge, Doc fights a squad of these winged demons that are carrying swords. And then, kind of cool, using one of the Stonehenge arches as a doorway, he goes through a portal and we get some awesome Starlin inspired by Ditko, you know, dimensional realm panels, which are great. And he winds up on an alien planet that's lush with jungle-like flora, but it's alive and attacks. And that's your Cthulhos, the agent of Shuma-Gorath, who presents to Strange as a, like, a Venus flytrappy type dude and tries to absorb him. But
I think we've also seen Starlin do the no-eyes skull thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this is like a Dreadstar tie-in in some way. Of a bit, and so that made me think of it. But I thought this was a fun, like, action packed. I could hear Spinal Tap during the Stonehenge segment, Steve.
I thought it was funny at the end that Strange escapes and kills him, and it's like, you know, with magic, and they really don't get any more specific than that. He uses magic.
Could have used some Kool-Aid to get rid of the thirsties, but you know.
I also like how all evil died with the Cthulhos, and I'm like, well, maybe not all evil.
The issue ends with Strange realizing, like, shoot, he's stuck there wherever there is and isn't around to stop Shuma-Gorath from rising like he's supposed to be.
Uh-oh.
And we never heard from Doctor Strange again.
I like, though, that this is the beginning of, you know, this is in... We're in the early 70s here, moving into the mid 70s. We're getting just not, you know, not simply good storytelling, but the artists are going out of their way to, you know, execute some really extra textures and extra artistic flair, you know, like the plant life and the vines have little thorns on them and stuff. And it's all, you know, the backgrounds, the cosmic stuff, the Starlin-esque planets, and it's all stuff we'd come to take for granted because now artists spend so much time on their craft, but this is still around the time when we're in that shift between people who are just cranking out pages, like in Gardner Fox's day, to this next generation of guys who were fans of those guys, but now they're working, and Starlin's becoming established enough to actually start spending some time on his art.
I want to see the person who doesn't think they got their 20 cents worth, Steve.
For real.
Yeah.
Marvel Feature began in 1971 and ran for 12 issues its first time around. The first three issues of Marvel Feature introduced the Defenders before they spun off into their own title, and then the next seven featured what was then modern Astonishing Ant-Man stories. You know, not like the old Strange Tales, Man in the Anthill kind of stuff. The last two issues of Marvel Feature in mid-1973, issues 11 and 12, had the Thing from the Fantastic Four teaming up with another character. You guessed it. And the title was then relaunched with Marvel 2-in-1, number 1, 2 months later, in October 1973. So both 2-in-1 issues of Marvel Feature were drawn by Jim Starlin, with inks by Joe Sinnott, with number 11 written by Len Wein, pitting the Thing against the Hulk in a contest between the Leader and Kurgo. And then issue 12 was written by Mike Friedrich, who, I mean, his Star Reach anthology in the 70s was not only one of the first indie books with top-notch creators, but totally one of my favorite indie anthologies of all time. And this one had the Thing and Iron Man and fighting Thanos' agents, the Blood Brothers.
They just should have teamed up with Iron Maiden.
This one definitely had that 2-in-1. The Thing is always in some blasted predicament, darn it. Yeah. And things kind of always go a little bit sideways for him with his... You know, he's usually on a bus or breaking up a newsstand or stuck somewhere. And that's what this one follows suit with, him always getting the kind of butt of the joke thing that became sort of a running bit in that 2-in-1. Although now, Kevin, you can flog Marvel Feature number 11 as the real number one for Marvel 2-in-1.
It's true.
Your next booth you're selling.
Right.
The Thing is stranded in the desert, and from the end of the previous issue, fighting the Hulk, and happens upon Iron Man fighting the Blood Brothers. Iron Man went back to check out the original location that he encountered Thanos in Iron Man 55, and instead encounters his goons, the Blood Brothers, and Thanos has directed them to kill Shellhead.
And you know, that controller looks like such a weird, like, old man, lumpy old man or something. It's just not what I think about when I think of the controller. You know what's also funny is this issue has the famous looks like Thanos is in the crapper type of seat here, where he's holding his cosmic cube,
his Metron throne.
Exactly.
I like this Thing though. I like that. Yeah. He's got the appropriate heft to him.
Joe,
the nice craggy rocks.
Joe
said
it's going to give you the best thing every time.
I'm a big fan, although I thought it was funny. The plot requires Iron Man to be like, I'm in too much of a hurry. I have to go fight Thanos alone. It would be worthless to bring the Thing with you. I mean, wouldn't it be better if he just didn't see the Thing? I'm thinking, if I'm going to fight Thanos, maybe I don't want to go by myself.
Yeah, he's
maybe one of the best of all fighters.
But that at least directs the Thing towards the direction that Iron Man flew to, because then the Thing comes upon the location there where Iron Man's fighting the Blood Brothers, and Iron Man flies in a hurry out the entrance and flies right into the Thing and takes himself out. Like, for a while Iron Man's out and the Thing, you know, fights them himself, and he finds out why they're called the Blood Brothers, too. they're galactic vampires, Kevin. So one of them tries to take a bite out of the thing. And, I mean, look out. That totally freaks him out. And he just pounds the crud out of the two of them by himself for a while until Iron Man finally wakes up and helps out.
We have to think.
Baron Blood trying to bite on Captain America, and then he discovers the chainmail.
For
sure.
That type
of scene.
Yeah.
I always liked the Blood Brothers because they're sort of stupid thugs, but they have a fun, you know, all the weird ridges and everything. But it looks like they're wearing like gym clothes or something. They just it seemed totally mix of like practical and weird sci-fi all in one.
I think they're
plus
like
the cool powers.
I think they're like a tag team wrestling.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I think that's their inspiration. They got the wristbands, you know, this is the 70s. So terry cloth wristbands were still in.
And they power each other and everything. It seemed like they don't really lean into that gimmick here. Now they're leaning into the equally cool galactic vampire gimmick. But that's what I think of them more for the gimmick. You got to separate them to defeat them sort of thing.
You got to keep them separated is what you got to do.
The Iron Man and the Thing come up with a great combo move where Iron Man grabs Ben's arm and swings Ben to like pick up like centrifugal force to add to the Thing's right hand and totally takes out the one of the Blood Brothers. It's like an early fastball special, but he never lets go. It's a pretty sweet move.
And you know, Steve, I love the double fist with the interlocked fingers. It seems such a practical punch that Shellhead does. But the other one I like is when one of them, who is it? I think it's Ben does the uppercut and Shellhead, yeah, does a cross. And I'm like, that must hurt. If they could time that perfectly, like imagine getting a superpowered uppercut and a full right cross, right, without any, you know, the guy wasn't blocking it or anything.
Thanos is watching this all and isn't amused at the lack of success that the Blood Brothers are having. So he seemingly disintegrates them for their failure using the Cosmic Cube. This is not going to have it.
Or does he?
No, he doesn't.
Well, I mean, that's a harsh penalty, guys. They're going to get yelled at, and then they'll have to go back and, you know, do KP duty or whatever.
The next year, in April 1974... Starlin guested in Giant Size Defenders number 1, which sported a Gil Kane, Frank Giacoa cover. This one was written by Tony Isabella with art by Jim Starlin and Al Milgrom. I mean, right from the splash page, you see the evolution of this, you know, Jim and I collaboration. I mean, the angular skulls and everything.
The eye black shadow that makes Hulk look a little Draxian with the green skin and the eye black. It's like King Diamond or whatever invaded the Marvel Universe.
Now here there are just 9 pages of material by this team. There's a 5-page framing sequence that presents 3 reprints, and then there's a 4-page resolution at the end. But it works, because it has Clea telling Valkyrie, a new member of the Defenders, about Namor, the Hulk, and Doctor Strange's pasts, which perfectly sets up the reprint tales. The first one's Incredible Hulk number 3, Kirby, Stan, and Dick Ayers, where the Hulk gets banished to outer space the first time and comes back under the complete control of Rick Jones, Andrew.
Yeah, I believe it or not, I've been reading these on the Unlimited. I actually tried to grab a cheap reader copy of this off of eBay. eBay's not great for that because of the shipping, and I got outbid. But I think I might at upcoming shows. I'm curious to see how these, when they reprinted these originals, what they looked like. So I'm like, there's no way I'm buying the originals of these. But I thought this was like a really cool way to see them kind of in regular print, especially the Namor one. I mean,
Yeah.
I own exactly zero Golden Age at Marvel books. So.
Well, that one was actually a Silver Age one. The Namor one is from Submariner 41 in 1955. But okay. it is written and drawn by Bill Everett, Namor's creator. And I mean, it's a nice example of Everett's evolution as an artist. Right from the first panel, you can see that, ooh, this artist has something extra to him that you don't usually see in Golden and Silver Age art, but it's got Teen Namor showing off. He's flying around in the air and he accidentally collides with a Nazi warplane and it knocks him unconscious. And when his mom wakes him up in his room, the tail of the warplane is like a trophy on his wall in his room.
Yeah, I just was like, ooh, I bet you this printed really cool, but it is more than I want to. Although I guess the big one for this is Giant Size 3 has some first appearance or whatever. So that's the one that's more expensive. I think that might be Korvac or somebody's first appearance that
and then
the made it expensive.
The Doctor Strange story is from Strange Tales 145, written by Stan with a script by Denny O'Neill and art by Steve Ditko. Where Strange faces a descendant of Rasputin. No, not that guy. Not the guy from Iron Man 56. And ultimately, Strange has to wipe Rasputin's knowledge of all magic to defeat him, which is pretty rough.
So, oh, he'll get over it, Steve.
Yeah.
So the Hulk, Namor, and Strange start reliving these pasts in the 4-page finale. I really like for the Rasputin character, Starlin uses that like blobby featureless outline trick that he'd use many more times down the line in his career. It's very effective and cool looking. And it turns out that Clea accidentally cast a spell while she was talking to Val. So as she was presenting these tales, they were coming to life and, you know, women.
Cool splash too.
How cool is Starlin and Milgram's Valkyrie in the armor and everything? Looks awesome. And the Hulk, man.
Yeah, I thought this was, like I said, fun to see that. Although, I'll be honest, I thought that Clea and Valkyrie looked very like different hairstyle. Their faces had a bit of a similarity to my eye. But yeah,
it's fun. Starlin, like I said, Starlin girl.
Grab this. I'm going to grab a copy of it if I can get a cheap one just to look at.
So Doctor Strange number 23 from March 1977 has a Gene Colan Tom Palmer cover. Gene was the regular artist on the title. And this is written by Marv Wolfman with Jim Starlin guest penciling and Rudy Nabriz providing, you know, typical pretty heavy Rudy Nabriz inks. Then Starlin would take over as the writer after Wolfman for a few issues and then pencil another issue 3 issues later. But first, issue 23 has Strange traveling to the Quadriverse where he has to protect its female guardian from a whole bunch of different attacks.
That's the first page you want to see if you're going to, you're like, oh, should I buy this?
I had this one as a kid.
Eyeballs and everything.
I had this one as a kid, and the cover, you know, didn't match the drapes. You know, like the cover was so weird looking with its tentacles and worminess, and then you open it up and completely different style and everything else.
It's like looks like a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow.
Oh, it's like psychedelic realms, alien monsters, mystical knights. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff here.
Lots of detail too, textures and you know, the trees and the skins and everything have all kinds of contours, and they really took some time with it.
You know, I speak of the heavy Nabriz inks as somewhat of a negative, but that's the positive that you get out of it is Nabriz does have a really great skills as far as his detailed texturing and all that stuff. He just makes every face look so angular and pointed. Not always to my liking. Doctor Strange number 26 from September 1977. It was a bi-monthly book, so three issues was like almost a year later. It has Starlin writing and providing the cover and doing layouts, with Nabreeze again finishing the art. I love this cover too. It's very Starlin-esque with the Ancient One's face and the skeleton. It's such a Starlin bones, and it does the thing with the hands and the big floofy pirate shirt again that I like.
And the weird, they're in some kind of weird nega space type of thing.
Yeah.
Mental space, but yeah, this is another fun one of lots of crazy details, and I thought this one had equally exciting monsters in space, and I really like Warthog Doctor Strange.
Yeah, at first I was like, is this Rintra early on? No, it wasn't. He was Stranger Yet. Doctor Stranger Yet. So the gist of this is that Strange is in search of the Ancient One for help, and finds that he's taken the form of a wino in an alleyway, where they're attacked by four servants of the creators. One of them being a floating eye guy that I like. And
the Ancient One. I always thought him was like one part, Professor X, one part Aunt May. You know, he had convenient weaknesses when he needed to, but super powerful when he needed to.
Strange does pretty good, actually, against these baddies, all except for that eye guy. The eye guy just cuts right through all of Strange's shields and everything. It's kind of cool. But the Ancient One gets some of his mojo back and helps Strange defeat the eye, then opens a portal and leads him through dimensions to his goal, his prize, the In-Betweener.
Yeah, it's the last page that really gets me.
Yeah, and the In-Betweener is another Starlin creation that debuted 2 years earlier in a Warlock comic in 1975.
Powerful. Came to life from an animation. He's the guy that does the sequences between the keyframes. That's the In-Betweener.
Oh, I thought he was the guy from Star Trek that is fighting the other guy, where one guy's black on one side and the other guy's white on the side.
There's another one. Yeah. Every time I hear In-Betweener, I'm like, isn't that the animation term for the frame between? Didn't Kirby start as an in-betweener? Maybe it's a tribute to him.
Remember,
he's got the robe, the short robe thing too. That's very old school.
Yeah, he reminds me of a Star Trek alien from the old Star Trek show. But the in-betweener is super powerful. I mean, in the Warlock thing, It was like the in-betweener coming was Warlock had to commit cosmic suicide to get away from him. It was pretty intense.
You know what's pretty funny is I painted an in-betweener.
Nice.
Because I got, like, they're blowing out, like, all these Star Trek, like they weren't really mini-mates. They were, like, bigger mini-mates. So it's funny that I cannibalized, like, a Star Trek mini-mate and painted him as an in-betweener.
Awesome. I love the cosmic entities, and Starlin certainly added to the Pantheon. The last book for tonight, for the Starlin issues at least, oh man, we got a lot of books coming, is Incredible Hulk 222 from January.
I'm going to say this is why I couldn't get into the Incredible, or why I wouldn't read the Incredible Hulk on like a regular basis.
That's fair. Although this is a fill-in issue, and it is a done-in-one type issue. It's from January 1978, so it's just 2 months after the Doctor Strange issue that we just talked about. And it's got a Starlin plot and layouts with a Len Wein script and Alfredo Alcala finished art. And I would say this is probably was an inventory story.
It seems like it.
It's got a Starlin Ernie Chan cover. But inside with the Alcala inks, I mean, talk about an animalistic, almost evil-looking Hulk. This made me just visually be like, ooh, man, I wish there was more of this Hulk out there.
Well, don't worry, it gets kind of cartoony at certain segments, Steve.
But it's a killer splash page, right? And Andrew, it's like evocative of the old like flathead Hulk.
Yeah, in the beginning, he's like some kind of troll the way and he's hunched over too, like a evil troll. It just gets a little goofy when the kids get introduced.
Yeah.
Well, the Hulk's being chased through the Badlands by the military, and it's not going well. Like, there's soldiers hanging from tree limbs. There's twisted tank turrets. It's just pissing the Hulk off as they pursue him. But we're getting great Hulk faces with the classic Starlin facial architecture underneath Alcala's inks. But watching this, as you point out, are two elementary school kids, Donnie and Marie. One's a little country, one's a little rock and roll. They observe the Hulk being gassed and wandering away, so they pounce on him when he passes out. Well, not really. They get their big brother Billy to drag him away. But what a big brother he must be to be able to drag the Hulk, right? So, back at their cave where they live, he's back to being Banner.
And there's a whole...
I just love the cave where they live. Perfectly normal kids, by the way. That's not a red flag or anything.
Well, there's this whole evil corporations, poisoning us. Brother Billy turns into a monstrous cannibal. What? Brother Billy kills mom and dad and moves into the cave with Sweet Cave, although it doesn't have any Wi-Fi, probably, with his little brother and sister. Oh, and sorry, he's going to eat Banner, too. That's why they
brother and sister.
There.
I think there's some emergency wear stores is what they are, Steve.
So Banner becomes the Hulk just in time to fight Brother Billy. And it's an epic fight. I mean, it goes on for a while. My favorite panel is when he takes the hilarious shot to the head with some falling rubble. And he's like, whoa. He turns into the Indian chief from F Troop sitting around the campfire with Larry Stork. Such a goofy face. But the fight between the Hulk and Brother Billy brings down the whole mountain, and Donnie and Marie wait for some movement in the rubble, and it's the Hulk that comes out victorious. And the Hulk lays some wisdom on the kids as the issue ends, though. He's like, they're like, did Billy make it? And he's like, bah, that was no Billy, only ugly monster. Monster tried to hurt Hulk, now monster gone forever. And then he looks with this little smile, knowing smile, and you could look deep into the Hulk's eyes and see that he really knows that he's laying it on him here. He's like the mayor of Reelsville here. If Billy was in cave, then Billy is gone forever, too. But Hulk thinks the one called Billy must have been lost a long time ago. A very long time ago. And off he starts running, and he's gonna jump.
Yeah, those kids will be fine in the desert, right, Steve?
Yeah, no problem.
With no means of support or anything.
This is, I think it's all a function of the gas that the Hulk took. That's my no prize there. This was all a dream.
Army will take care of those kids.
Yeah, we should bring the new story where the kids have grown up as weapons trained by the Army to attack the Hulk.
But Kevin, I hear you, right? I mean, that's the problem with the Hulk. It's the army chasing him.
Yeah.
And occasionally some big other brute, him fighting some big other brute. In small doses with a interesting writer or some good guest star or a connection that matters in the greater tapestry of Marvel history and stuff, I can take these stories. But on the month-to-month, it's pretty tough.
Yeah, it takes much time until I get more interested in the Hulk and I want to look back at all.
I really like the art on the John Severin inked stuff, for sure. But I still wasn't a regular reader of the Hulk until... Because when I was a kid buying comics, we were more into the, Sal Buscema drawn stuff. And it wouldn't be until he was super smart Hulk and started to lose it on the march up to 300 that I would actually start being a monthly reader, because the whole thing started around
I'm just shooting this number out of my head, but like around maybe like 286 or 5 or something like that, where the Hulk gets amnesty from the president, right? He's like cleared of all his crimes. And it's like, this is a new day for the Hulk. Banner's in control. Everybody loves him. And then he starts the descent where the corner boxes start showing him getting more and more savage, right?
That's so good. The March of 300, that's Smash Tales to me.
Ah, nice. Well, that was when I started buying it monthly, and then I would stop buying it when I would get out of reading comics while the Hulk was still in the Crossroads before he and the Alpha Flight creative team would switch.
Yep. Anyway, but that's our selection of Starlin penciled fill-in books from the 70s. Although, admittedly, it's just a sampling. There's a lot of other Starlin fill-in books. We could do this again some other time if we wanted. But we're on a roll here, guys, so let's catch our breaths and come out swinging with some modern books.
Okay, we've got this Recent Reads Roundtable on deck for you, but thanks to a heads-up from our friends at the Time Variance Authority, we've learned that Skrull saboteurs have work to intercept and block transmissions from the bunker. Now, hang tight, True Believer, we've got this. But just as Kevin starts in on Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, the cartoon, we've got to repel their strike with some combination of the Ultimate Nullifier and McCarran Crystal to reset reality. Long story short, we're losing a minute of Kevin's praise for that show. But just go ahead anyway, Kevin, you got this. I'll even set you up. What you been reading?
Kevin, I think I've been watching things rather than reading. It couldn't be more my jam.
Yes, I know you like that, where they kind of pop all over the place. I feel like they sometimes skip some of the frames when they do the animation that way. And I know you also like all the emojis and symbols and everything is your thing.
It's so good, especially since Devil Dinosaur doesn't really talk.
But he does talk, and she translates for you.
I know, it's just hilarious that he's always grumbling and go, "Haha." It's kind of like he's doing a Mr. Bean thing. It cracks me up all the time. And then he's like emoticoning and doing all the stuff. And then she's like, "Yeah, tomorrow's a big day." And then he's like, "Rah, rah, rah." And then she's like, "Not hot dogs." And it has like his not thoughts, but yeah, the like a picture of a hot dog or something. And then he's like, "Rah."
Yeah, it's like a lot of emojis and symbols, yes, and text and everything. Yeah, I thought, boy, I bet you Whirlwind X is jiving on this, but
well, you know why too? It's like a combination of Jim Mahfood doing a cartoon, and then you mix in the 60s Spider-Man cartoon and all that craziness and the colors, you just pour some Zipitone and textures on top. But like, if this was a comic, we'd be going, "Oh, look at all the Zipitone they use there."
Well, the music's pretty significantly different from the 60s Spider-Man.
I mean,
you don't have those kind of orchestrated musical pieces. And like I said, I feel in some of the motion sequences, I think for in the modern style is you kind of skip out frames to make the characters move quicker. They don't do it on their mouths so much, but in some ways it did remind me of the 60s Marvel cartoons of like,
nice,
sort of strange movement back and forth, like you say, almost storyboards of a comic.
Yeah.
But I'm less into that. I like a kind of a more fluid, less things jumping around all the time, and a more fluid, like they should have just rotoscoped a real dinosaur, Kevin. Then I would have been happy.
I just love that he's there. Oh man, it is so good that Devil Dinosaur is in a cartoon doing stuff, wandering through the city, eating hot dogs, jumping in the trash.
I mean, I like her little sidekick friend, Cassie.
Yes.
She was like, nice. Yes. Like, she was like a funny social media commentary. Her friend is into like live streaming and posting online and all that, which I hear the kids like.
Is there a Snuffleupagus aspect where, like, she never actually sees the dinosaurs because she's the one who would be posting it all online, or no?
It's no, she does. She's their street team.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they end up forming friends, and she's promoting Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur.
Yeah.
So it takes a bit to get to that. And, you know, that's why the first one, I don't know if it aired that way, but on the Disney Plus, the first episode is twice as long.
You know, I looked for it on the Disney Plus, didn't see it. So I've just been watching it on Disney and on demand. So,
yeah, maybe in Canada it's different, but down here on the
Plus, what I'm thinking.
I don't know if you were watching an original air date, if that first one was split into two episodes. It is funny on the
Plus,
they have the transitions for commercials. And it's,
yeah,
you know, it's the plate to go to commercial and plate right to come back or right next to each other.
Yeah.
It's always funny when you're on.
They've been airing two episodes at a time, so I don't know if they're, like, they're definitely caught up, but I think they just air them back to back anyways.
Okay.
So that, like, that's kind of weird. But you said there's no, like, you're talking about the music. A certain someone with a Jerry curl shows up in the sixth episode. And I'm like, what is happening? I can't believe they've stuck this in here. Because they've combined some villains. I'm not entirely sure if all of these are, like, made up new villains or if some of them appeared, like, in the Moon Girl comic. There's definitely some characters where it's like they do that little, like, James Bond intro bit where they just have, like, the villain of the moment. And one of them, you're like, oh, it's going to be like some like a stilt man or something. And it's like, no, it's a stiletto, but it's a stiletto stilt man. And I was just like, what is happening? And then meanwhile, the Beyonder is talking in Lunella's ear. And she's like, how come someone's here narrating my life and talking to me? And then she gets distracted. The villain almost gets away, but then she takes out her little water gun pistol that shoots like a big water bubble, and it catches the stilt man, not stilt man, stiletto. And then the Beyonder introduces himself, and it's like, what? And he's like, I'm here to judge all humanity. And I'm like, and I'm just like leaning forward the whole time. I'm like, I wonder if she has to tell him about going to the bathroom. And while he's singing his monologue about humanity, there's a montage, and you see toilet paper.
And
it
I'm
is
not
so good.
I don't know a lot about actors, but there are some voices. Alfre Woodard is in it. She's like the grandma, I think. And Alison Brie was in the first episode as the bad guy. So they went and got some. Like I said, I'm not really I don't know names of actors that well or anything. But even for a buffoon like me to be like, oh, I recognize this person type of thing.
Yeah.
So there are some big names attached to it. But yeah, it was fine. I just was kind of drifting during it and watching my phone as much as the show. So not sure I'll continue.
Like, I don't think the intro is like in some ways the most interesting thing, because out of all the episodes, because they sort of have to set stuff up. And then after that, they can just sort of run with all the stuff after.
I can see that. And I also don't know how. I don't think I know any. I mean, I have some relatives, but I'm so tangential to them. I don't really know a lot of 13-year-olds, so I don't know how current it reflects their slang and concern about online stuff and all that. So that might be another point of distance for me, as I'm not up on the lingo or what. I mean, I know I can tell what's going on, but I can't speak to its authenticity or whatever. I didn't have a problem with it, but I don't know, like, oh, that's so how they would totally say that, or that's so how they wouldn't. Don't know.
Yeah, like, same. Like, I don't know. Like, I just see, like, you just see graffiti and like, people rhyming things and everything, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess that, like, that's modern, in quotes, stuff. Maybe it isn't, but, you know.
Yeah, who am I to say whether it is or not? I don't know.
I don't know. It's fun though. It's a good show. So I mean, after 2 years of complaining that Marvel didn't have any cartoons, I'm glad we have a cartoon. I mean, we sort of had a cartoon, but not in the way we had a bunch of cartoons before.
Oh, Kevin just dissing Hitmonkey and MODOK pretty authoritatively. Guess we know. I mean, he wasn't TV excited too. About.
Not like that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, we had that stuff.
I think Hitmonkey's like getting a second season.
If you can't sell a Spider-Man cartoon or a Batman cartoon, like, what are you doing? Like, what can you sell?
I mean,
I don't know, it's weird.
Hey, you know, the 1978 Marvel calendar, which was Spider-Man centric, the dates match up to this year, which is kind of fun.
So you're using that?
This, yeah, I happen to have an old copy, which is great.
Not my original copy. It's got all these things written from 1978, like Jimmy's 8th grade birthday party on Tuesday.
But this is this is a Jack Kirby one with the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man. There's a Paul Gulacy one with all Spider-Man's villains and Spidey. There's Perez does one with the monsters. It's an awesome calendar.
You know, speaking of calendars, I never checked on the other years for my Marvel calendars, but something clued me in this year that maybe something is happening, because February, they had the Falcon there, and I'm like, okay. Then March, St. Patrick's Day, they have the Hulk, and I started going, wait a second, are they theming this calendar?
The December of the 1978 is a John Byrne, Joe Sinnott piece that has Spider-Man in the middle and like the whole Bronze Age Marvel universe in the background, from Kazar to Power Man, Iron Fist to Man-Thing and Nova and Werewolf by Night and Deathlok and the Inhumans, and Spider-Woman still has the head cap with the, you know, her hair's not showing. Pretty cool.
Wait, that's a weird Kevin,
costume with the head cap.
You're telling me that Dr. Bruce Banner is Irish?
Is he green?
Yeah, but you said St. Patrick's Day, so that was the
yeah, it's in March.
Irish. Yeah, so is he Irish, you know?
Hey, but that doesn't
I'm aware of.
That doesn't count as my book, though. And since you mentioned green, let me stay with the green theme. And there was it's still ongoing as the time of this recording, but probably will be wrapped up by the time we air it. There is a second Secret Invasion series, one that began in 2022 and have spilled over into 2023. I think it's going to be 6 issues in total, written by Ryan North, with art by Francesco Mobili. And it's a sequel to the Secret Invasion, you know, the whole Bendis Skrull thing. But this one is pretty much like a Nick Fury Jr. and Maria Hill story, where Maria discovers someone pretty important as a Skrull, and then has to question their whole, like, existing detection methods and find new ones, and she has to develop a new detection method and then go around and test people, right? And you got to test the Avengers first because, you know, they're always around having meetings and stuff, and they're available. They're willing. They'll stick out their arm. But she also eventually comes to odds with Tony Stark, and I mean, like, really at odds. Like, they're, like, fighting each other. And then I'm thinking, he was kind of the other principal player in that whole Secret Invasion time, because that was when he was director of S.H.I.E.L.D., right? It was Osborn shooting the Skrull Queen on TV that brought down S.H.I.E.L.D. and made him be the new leader of it, that he turned into Hammer, taking it over from Stark. So I guess it makes sense that Stark is the other player between Fury Jr. and Maria Hill.
And it's not a drill. This isn't like a false alarm. There are Skrulls doing it again. They're replacing and invading, and there's a whole scheme at work. Lots of drama, lots of action. The art's good. I mean, I wasn't that jazzed to read it when I started. Like, I waited for a few issues to pile up, and I'm like, oh, it seemed like they have been going out of their way. Marvel has to redo titles that they had in the past, like the names, and I don't know if that's part of that whole, like when they did that Secret Wars and they found, oh, this is a great way to keep the, you know, the license on these trademarks on these titles to have them come back out again. It's, they just did like a Planet Hulk thing, and they did, you know, an Atlantis Attacks thing not too long ago. There was a few things that popped up.
Yeah.
And I wasn't too happy with most of them, so I wasn't too psyched for this one, but I got pretty quickly invested in it. Like, it was pretty engaging, pretty quick. They kept it to, first it's like a Nick Fury story, and then it kind of becomes very Maria Hill focused for the whole rest of it. It's a good book.
Yeah, they've done a few Planet Hulks. I was just imagining you ordering it. You're like, well, I'm not really that excited for this, but I'll order it anyway.
This will be your secret invasion, Steve. The one you really get fired up about.
I liked the other one. The whole build-up was problems. A lot of fun.
I mean, I thought the cartoon, the two-episode adaption on the cartoon was better than the comic.
Hmm.
Since all cartoons come back, but not really.
Earth's Mightiest Heroes was a good one, though. I like that one.
Yeah.
I picked books that Kevin suggested for mine.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
So we're going with Bloodline, Daughter of Blade. Because, Kevin, did you read this one? You said you might read it.
I felt like I had to, since I said I might read it. And then I thought, oh, no, Andrew's going to read this. And I feel obligated. I'm like, I have to team up with him on this.
Yeah, Danny Lohr, Karen Darbo, Chris Peter. So yeah. Finding out about secret vampires in the real world.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I'm like, this seems like newish. And it's like, I have no idea really who the creators are, but I'll give it a go, right? Because, you know, I'm into trying new things. And I feel like this has long been delayed. Like, I think Tim Seeley was originally supposed to do something, and then he ended up with that other vampire thing instead.
No, I don't know. I haven't been keeping up. I was like, vampires? What happened to the Montesi formula?
if you haven't read Avengers, like, they have a whole country.
Wasn't that like 900 reboots ago with that one? But so this features the Blade's daughter who doesn't know the background.
Yeah.
Having times with her mom. And I thought it was interesting that they decided not to play everything out in the issue. And I really was glad they kind of got into it, because some of the stuff happens off panel, which I appreciated, because I was like, I'm glad we have a good chunk of compression here. Because, as you guys know, sometimes I don't really like when they really belabor things. Like, we get into, she discovers her powers, finds out about vampires, finds out about her mom. Like, all that happens in the first issue, which I am here for. So if people are like, gosh darn it, Andy, too much happens, I want to find out how this goes, this is not the book for you. But I was glad to have them just talk about stuff off, because I don't need to see them, wait, I'm super strong, you know, whatever the thing is. I've read enough first issues, I'm good. As before, with the teen daughter, I'm not really in a place to opine on its authenticity to the current era, but it certainly felt real to me. But yeah,
I have those moments where they're like, there's like a school thing, and I'm like, I guess it's another country, I guess they're really strict, I guess this could happen, because I don't know, I just, some stuff just strikes me as weird, like, oh, this, well, we have to she's not doing extracurricular activities, so we got to pull her mother into school for an emergency meeting. And I'm just like, I guess.
Now, well, I liked how it went against that, because the mom was like, ugh, is there, aren't her grades fine? Let's
leave. Exactly.
So that played out differently than we've seen.
I think you're like on the mother's side.
Yeah.
I've got questions for the panel here.
What happened to the backgrounds? Well, Steve, in the 80s, they found out you don't need backgrounds.
Is Blade in it?
Yes.
He is in it at the end. So yeah. He's going to get teamed up because he's working with T'Challa, and they dropped some crack about Dracula. And that's why I was like, I'm pretty sure the Darkhold took care of him about 40 years ago. So I wouldn't come on. Worry.
Don't you remember Captain Britain when Dracula was shooting vampire missiles from the moon?
No, wait, wasn't? I'm pretty sure Dr. Sun was the last.
Because here's why I ask, because at the end of last year of 2022, there was a Blade Vampire Nation one shot written by Mark Russell with art by Dave Wachter, right? Dave Wachter, yeah. We like that guy. And this was a really good one-shot, and it had the current status quo of Blade, where he's like the sheriff of Toontown. But it's
still is.
You know, it's Dracula's has this nation of vampires in Chernobyl. Yeah. And there's a murder, and there's kind of powerful vampires as they've set themselves up in society, that it's kind of like a white-collar thing, and Blade has to go and rattle cages and investigate it and everything. And it was a really, I thought, a very fun book. And when I saw this Daughter of Blade thing, I was like, this is not what I want to read, and not where I wanted Blade to go. I want more Blade, the Sheriff of Vampire Nation.
Well, he just gets another book where Blade shows up.
So. Avengers? He just gets, I don't pulled, want that either.
No, not Avengers. At the end.
Because he, now that she's finding out, she didn't know about this history and everything. Mm-hmm. So now that she's going to get, now that she's found out about vampires and what's going on and everything, she has to get pulled into the loop, and Blade is going to be the one. Plus, I also imagine they were like, come on, let us have Blade show up in our number one comic, sure. So we can have her have that cameo thing, because he is on the cover. Yeah. Look, I don't need crazy backgrounds, but yeah, I'm not super thrilled with the exactly. Oh, don't worry. The colorist will just put a wash back there. It happens a lot in this one. And, you know, hey, I read how many 80s comics with no background, so I feel pretty rich complaining about it here. Well, and the other thing I don't know is
you were reading DC?
That, I'm just kidding. Well, wow. I was thinking about Alpha Flight, Steve.
Yeah.
A lot of those with just pink backgrounds. But I also, as you guys know, I like the colorist does do a lot of work making backgrounds, but I really don't like that. We're just going to wash this sequence in one primary color as kind of doing too much lifting, I feel like. Well, and it's just a stylistic thing I don't like. And I know, like, oh, it's at night, so it shows that. Or it's this thing, so that's the light. But I just would rather have more color breakdowns. Go on, Kevin. Prove me wrong.
If we're not on the third artist by the fifth issue, then I'll say that the color backgrounds were a success.
It
seems like at some point they're like, oh, the reader expects everything to be drawn and the backgrounds to be filled with stuff, and then at some point they're like doing like three issues a year or something. So I'm like, if that's what you got to do, I'm like, I'm fine with having some titles have like that kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I don't think I'm the target audience for this book.
I don't probably think you are.
You might not be, but I think you should
read the other vampire books, Steve, and report back.
I enjoyed it. If I see issue two and everything, I will keep buying it for a while. All the goofing on the background isn't a barrier to entry for me. I just feel like that kind of color wash thing is a bit overplayed at this point. But maybe that's just the style, and overplayed. I need to get with the times, old man.
No, out of all the number ones I read recently where they set up like new status quos and stuff, this wasn't as strong as those, but, you know. Also might be because of Blade and subject matter and everything, too. So, like, I'm just going to be automatically into, like, a Wasp setting up a bar and Al Ewing writing it. Like, that seems like something I'd be way more into instead, so.
Well, staying with these Fringe books, kind of on the we're on the C books here. As far
how
as
dare
the,
you, Steve,
the character.
When this issue hits number 500, Steve, I'll expect a full apology.
When this miniseries becomes an ongoing series,
I read another miniseries. Oh, sorry, it's Marvel limited series that had. Is a sequel to a sequel that there's been a few with this title. This one was last year in 2022. I think it's the third or fourth series with this title, actually, and that's Damage Control. This one, though, is written by Adam Goldberg and Hans Rodenoff from the Goldbergs, TV writers.
Yeah, I think we talked about the first issue of this one, Steve, a little bit, because I remember saying I was having trouble getting into it, and you said stick with it.
Yeah, I read all five issues. The first two issues are drawn by Will Robson, with covers by the late Carlos Pacheco, and the last three issues are drawn by Nate Stockman, with Patrick Zerker doing the covers. But you don't really notice the art change, because they both have this, like, Todd Nauck Corey Hampshire-esque style. And what the deal is that the series follows a new hire at Damage Control, so we just experience the operation through his eyes, and each issue has him trying out a new position, and it doesn't work out, so then they move him to another role, which allows you to see all these different aspects of Damage Control. You know, complete with a lot of gags and a lot of character cameos and stuff. Like, he tries the mailroom, fielding insurance claims, a search and rescue, research and development, and finally is exiled to the isolation of deep storage vaults, where he comes across, like, all these rare... You don't know, it's like the basement of the at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, there's just all these different items and all these boxes, some cataloged, others not. But he comes across Jocasta's head and accidentally facilitates like a robot uprising, because then she then turns on like one of the Kree sentries, who then turns on Machine Man, and then he like goes over and turns on two other guys, like they got a sentinel turned on, and all of a sudden there's like a robot rebellion going on, and he's like, this is getting out of hand. I thought that was pretty clever. And one of the executives, the boss that he reports to, looks just like Dwayne McDuffie, so I thought that was a nice touch too.
Yeah, very nice touch.
I thought it was fun.
The new Warriors didn't show up.
I don't think so. Maybe there was a lot of cameos. Everybody from Moon Knight to MODOK. There was a lot of characters in there. You know, you go to the break room and it's just. I mean, there's a lot of characters drawn, and because it's that really clean style too, it comes across. Everybody looks a little bit sort of rubbery and almost crossing into looking like an animated, not anime, but animated style. It's good. Enough.
You know what else was good?
Was that?
Amazing Spider-Man.
Really?
We got a two-issue story that... Well, after that event...
Yeah.
Dark web.
Yeah.
I guess, they need a little bit of time to prepare for their next arc.
And that's what you prefer.
And
the filler. The filler really struck a chord with you.
I'm going to say that the filler is better than anything else in this entire run so far.
Nice.
Because, I mean, you get superstar filler. Like, guest writer Joe Kelly. I like Joe Kelly. guest penciler and colorist and inker, the Dodsons.
Nice. Oh, I did read this. I read the first one of these issues.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, it looks very nice. I mean, how could it not look really nice?
Totally.
I mean, and then it sort of reminds me of, like, how was that miniseries, right, that I never finished?
No? The Black Cat one?
Yeah, because that just, like, the delays were terrible. No,
you're right. It was like it was the last issue, like almost a year late or something, or
yeah, something like that.
Yeah, the Kevin Smith written.
Yeah,
but that was good.
Oh wow, though. We're going back in the Wayback Machine.
Oh yeah, I mean some of those Kevin Smith issues just yeah. But yeah, like it's funny they have a cover that's like worst date ever, and you're like, oh, what are we getting into here? So, I mean, I could see someone saying, oh, this is just too goofy, but my kind of goofy, definitely. So we get into some crazy hijinks. I mean, they're going out of town, and they just happen to run into MJ on a possible romantic spa ski vacation type of thing. Like Peter, Black Cat, and MJ, and whoever. I don't remember the guy's name now that she's with. But anyhow, they all run into each other. And then, since... and also, Andrew's gonna love when White Rabbit shows up. I mean...
Classic character.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, especially the Dodsons. Like, I bet you they render the White Rabbit in a very... iconic look. Right?
I would say so.
Yeah, they know how to draw striking lady characters.
But isn't she cutting in a little bit on Hobgoblin's game? Wasn't his game to like franchise out or like rent costumes to people?
Yeah, but I mean that's an old wheeze that's been going on. Remember the Fixer was doing that like in the 60s or whatever. So you can't really knock someone for doing the old helping people out to get a piece of the action sort of thing. Like that's a classic storyline.
But yeah, there's a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of renting of costumes, people not knowing how to use costumes and gear and everything.
Yeah, or we're like the power broker and they don't know how to use their power, like they're trashing stuff out or whatever.
And then it sort of becomes a murder mystery. And then a lot of back and forth where since Black Cat isn't always like exactly on the right side of the law. So White Rabbit's all like, oh, you understand me and everything. And it's not always a mutual get along here. But I mean, I just thought
bad this... about the White Rabbit, Kevin.
But this is just so much fun and so much goofing around that I'm like, I mean, nothing against the regular creative team, but can we have a few more issues with this creative team?
Right.
With this guest team?
That's the problem.
Yeah, I like the Dodsons.
The Dodsons can't do a monthly book, though. They can do a few issues, though.
That's true. I'm surprised that we actually got two issues with like the Dodsons, because with the Avenger Man and stuff like that.
Yep.
I mean, I'm happy with what we got anyway, so, you know.
I mean, I know this doesn't count, but I am... actually kind of excited for that Scott Koblish Fantastic Four where he's doing the same thing he does where he puts like a million characters. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah.
Oh, is that like 800?
Yeah, something like that. Crazy amount. And he does such a good job with those. So I am very excited to see that. I'm trying to remember. He did it fairly recently for maybe the Deadpool or something like that.
Yes,
he did
yes.
one of those crazy covers with, you know, 75 care. And I was talking to him about it years or one of those years back. And Yeah, those are not easy to do, as you might imagine. But they're always so visually, it's like find Where's Waldo or whatever type of thing.
Yeah, that's why when I got one of my one of the few lithograph things I have, it's the one where it's like the four. It's like every Marvel Universe character up to a certain time, but I guess they were like four different pieces, four different covers or something, and they put them all together into one image. So there's, yeah, it's definitely a Where's Waldo thing. You're just looking at it forever going, I know who that guy is. Where's this guy? So much fun.
Well, since you just mentioned Spidey, I should dovetail on that because I read the Spider-Man title from 2022 that's written by Dan Slott with art by Mark Bagley and John Dell. And I didn't know what I was getting into here. And as I waited for a few issues to pile up as I usually do, and I start reading and I'm realize, holy cow, like, you know, the whole Spider-Verse series of miniseries and events have really run their course when the latest installment here that is subtitled The End of the Spider-Verse is just given an adjectiveless Spider-Man title. Like, they don't even advertise that it's a Spider-Verse thing. But, you know, the creators are solid. It's Slott and Bagley. And, in fact, it's actually back to business because I thought it was the last few Spider-Verse series, not the Edge ones, because I know those, the Edge of Spider-Verse ones usually like introduce a few new characters that then get used in some kind of Spider-Verse series or whatever, but it seemed like
this title,
there was like a Spider-Gwen centric one and a Spider-Miles centric one and maybe a Venom centric one not too long ago, but this seems like it gets back, like it's more of a direct sequel to Slott's Spider-Verse event than any of the actual sequels have been. Like, the stakes are big. That Morlun character is back, but he's actually back because he needs help. His family, the Redeemers, have all been destroyed. That Shathra character that looks kind of like Mephisto's son, Blackheart, kind of, but it's more insecty, whatever. The female, she's conquered Loom World and has the great web and everything. And there's the Julia Carpenter Spider-Woman as Madame Web. And then there's also the regular Spider-Woman that's featured too, which is good. But Shathra's turning all of the spider characters into her like evolved hive of drones that they're calling like wasps. So she's got this army of Spider-Verse characters, and the circle's closing in on the ones that are left. You've got Spidey and the Spider-Womans and Silk and Anya and a few variants. Like, one of them's a Kraven Spidey, which is kind of cool. And another,
yeah, it was from the Edge, I think.
Yeah, yeah. They always do that, right? And then another one's the like a Black Cat Spider-Man.
Well, there's some really good ones, though. I don't know how far you're going with this, Steve, but there's some really, like, I'm like, they did that?
there's also this thing where there's a blade that removes individuals from the Great Web, and you get surprised not once but twice as to who gets the treatment. So it's like, it's spiders to the walls action. Very much like the old Spider-Verse stuff. The characterization is really good. I think it's good. Check it out when it's on the Unlimited. It's worth it.
Well, if we're going spider stuff and trolling Kevin, picked up Spider-Gwen Shadow Clones number one.
I just picked that up today.
This is Emily Kim in Ki Zama and Triona Farrell on colors. And this one has a real big, to me, like, the art is so 80s indie book that I'm really and I says really bummed it's in color in a way. Like, I know we don't like, not the colorist does great, like it's no knock, but I just, it would really sell the 80s indie look if this was in black and white. And also, like, Ghost Spider, Spider Gwen works. I love how in the intro they're setting it up, like when teenager Gwen Stacy suits up in her synthetic symbiote suit, she has blah 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 blah. You know, she's known as Ghost Spider, but you know her as Spider Gwen. I love how they're still trying to sell that Ghost Spider business, but
yeah,
they know it's too late. Like, Spider Gwen is the one that does it. And, you know, yeah, there's just like super detail in some panels and then flat backgrounds in the other, and the character designs are cool, but it's a wacky Earth 65. Spider Gwen finds a Doc Ock clone of her, and then it hints her other clones, like it ends with a Sandman clone of her. And so if you like all those alternative versions, and look, that's what, it's smart for them to do, like they're not going to lose rights creating real new heroes, so why not just endlessly spin the dial on these spider variations and have fun with it? But yeah, this is the one that I would have loved to have in black and white if we can do one, but kind of designed for black and white, so they would do like hashing or whatever for some of the backgrounds and everything. Yeah, very 80s look on a lot of these characters. Indie.
Kevin? This is one of those situations where, like with the Thunderbolts, when they were in another alternate reality, and then 2 seconds later, they go to another alternate reality, and then I go, ah, really? Same thing with with the Spider-Gwen series. Like, we've already been, hey, we saw all these different Gwens, and now it's like the series after, we see all these different Gwens, and I'm like, again? Like, sometimes it drives me a little mad.
That's her
but
thing.
Andrew, did you pick up the design Peach Momoko cover, though?
No, the one I have is signed D.NA. I don't know which.
David Nakamura.
Yeah.
Okay. Because there's like a, as you might imagine, a million of these. I will say, like, the cover, radically different from the insides, at least this, this David Nakayama, that's the one, right? Yeah, it's... It didn't bother me because I like the insides, but yeah, if you thought that's what the insides look like, no, this is a total different Kizama. It looks totally, yeah. I'm just like, man, I'm back in the comic store and it's 1982 and I'm grabbing some weird black and white book with some crazy Spider Woman on the cover.
I wonder if they were the one that did that Death's Head miniseries from a few years ago.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
All right, the last book I got for you is the most recent Alien title, which is the second Marvel Alien series that started last year in 2022 and has spilled over into 23. And it still has my pal Philip Kennedy Johnson writing, even though he's given a new number one, although it's his third 6-issue arc. But whatever. This time they have him paired with a plenty capable artist, Julius Ota. And, well, first of all, I really like that Kennedy Johnson and editorial include in their catch-up prose paragraphs, they have the paragraphs be like little blurbs that are a timeline that have put each existing arc that Johnson has done, you know, in order. So you get to see the evolution of the story, because sometimes it's like 100 years or 70 years, 30 years between the stories. Despite them being pretty self-contained, there are some connective tissue. So it just gives you that, you know, fictional historical context that I like. But it also tells you from the first movie, too, so you can see where it all connects. It's cool. And so lots of years have passed, and I gotta say, I'm sorry to see other creators are handling upcoming issues. I mean, I'm a bit biased because he's a good friend, but I think Kennedy Johnson's done really good writing this Alien book. And this one features a squad of synthetic human elite commandos with, you know, like heightened abilities and everything, going to this planetoid that we've seen previously that was overrun by aliens. They need to retrieve this alien egg that is going to be used by Weyland Yutani, that is the, you know, the evil corporation of the alien fictional universe. And so this squad of elite synthetic commandos encounter aliens all over the place, and also a tribe of surviving humans and a few other surprises. It's a good arc, as has been the previous two. He's written good stuff with the alien. I hope that he gets a chance to do more, unless his story is told.
I'm thinking it might be told.
No way. Let this guy write when the alien joins the Avengers. That's what I say.
Yep, Savage Avengers, Andrew.
If
Savage
Conan
Avengers
can do it, they can have an alien and a predator on the team.
Like the daughter of an alien predator hybrid thing that... Sigh.
I really hope Declan Shelby is writing a Savage Avengers for the next Alien with Predator on the same team. I'm going to try it out, I think. Maybe. We'll see. I say that, and then we'll see what happens when, you know, I mean, Aliens isn't entirely my thing, but...
Me neither. I haven't read much of the years that Dark Horse had the title, other than if there was like a really good creative team, right? Like, I was like, well, if my other pal, Ron Mars, is doing an Aliens bit with... you know, Batman and Bernie Wrightson or whatever, I'm reading that for sure. And I haven't seen all the movies. I really liked the first movie a lot, but after that, it kind of bummed me out that it seemed like if you had six bullets in your gun, you could kill six aliens. And I liked it better when it was one alien, and that was more than a whole crew could deal with. More the haunted house angle of it. And this is fun because he has put a few different scenarios. Like, I like the last one that was like aliens on a planetoid that was a breadbasket. So it was like a prairie. So you had like, you know, horse drawn carriages and wagons and stuff. And like xenomorphs climbing over him and like attacking the barn and stuff. I thought that was pretty cool. And then this is a neat idea too, because it's a bunch of basically like superheroes in a way. They don't shoot fire out of their hands or anything, but they are more like John Carter, Warlord of Mars, where like they can jump and they're enhanced and they have faster reflexes and they're smart and they're super skilled at all these different weapons and stuff. So it's interesting to see them do well for a while, and see how things go and deal with the situations that pop up. I think he paces these stories pretty good, that you're not set up, you know, like a Godzilla movie. You don't want to have to deal with the humans too much, right? So it's like you want to get right to the action, and this, I think, bridges it a little bit because these characters are a little more than human, so and it's a small squad of characters that gets smaller and smaller as the issues go on, which, you know, is my formula for jumping into a new storyline or scenario or characters or world or title, is to pare down those characters and get right to the action. So
yeah, I think more of the Planet of the Apes guy.
Those two singing girls in the box in those Godzilla movies.
Mothra. They sang for Mothra. That,
I feel like they kind of slowed the thing down a bit. I want to see a...
Except that you knew that you were going to get to see Mothra at some point.
Yeah, I
want to
see a guy in a rubber suit stepping on models, Steve. That's what I'm there for.
Mothra was the one creature that they like that the humans, you know, could not control, but like work to the benefit of humans, you know. He would like try to calm Godzilla down.
Yeah, I love those ones. Man, once they ditched the rubber suit,
yeah,
I don't know. They never got the magic again, you know.
I don't know. The one time I wanted to see humans was when I thought it was Breaking Bad meets Godzilla. That was probably pretty much like one of the best intros to a Godzilla movie.
Also, are they changing the weird little boxes? Because in my effort to troll Kevin, I also got Rogue and Gambit number one. And the box looks different. It's on the outside edge and the print is different. Like, it has that bonus digital edition details inside, but it's not bolded or anything. And I was like, are they doing a new style or something? Or is this just for this one issue? It was weird.
You mean the box inside?
No, on the cover in America, when they print them, they have a UPC code. And it indicates that there's this, it has the language, digital bonus digital edition details inside.
There is no box. It has the price.
And the rating. Yeah, I'm talking about the American versions.
There's American versions?
Yeah, and on the cover...
Why would they make American versions?
It's usually... Sometimes it's... If it's on the bottom, it's usually oriented along with the regular text. Or it's along the staple edge cover, and they're oriented up and down.
So what you're saying is you have all these different variants, and I have the rare ones.
Yes, and what it is it says bonus digital edition, and the digital edition is in red, and and the rest of it is all in black.
Yes.
Except, Kevin, you said you don't have this box on your issues.
No, it isn't. There is no box anymore. No, it's just the text in with the price and everything.
Yeah.
Because they used to prominently feature it more. Now it's just included with everything.
No, in America they print it on the cover of the comic.
Yes, it is printed on the
bonus
cover.
Bonus digital edition details inside, and those are in bold letters, except on this are. Rogue and Gambit. No, not on
I'm
this
confused
Rogue
what you're
Gambit.
You're saying there's American versions.
I'm saying that on all my other recent Marvel comics, the box that says bonus digital edition details inside is in bold font, and digital edition is in red.
Yes.
On Rogue and Gambit, that is not true.
Oh, that's, yeah, because the X-Men books have their, they were all designed from when the Hickman era started by, was it Tom Mueller or something? I think they're still following those designs.
Yeah, so it's just weird that they have the same verbiage, but no bold, no red lettering.
Because all the X-Men books have to have a uniform style.
Yeah, and I just thought it was a neat look. I mean, the corner box with the issue number and all that is all that style.
That's what I
didn't realize that.
You could win a Toys R Us sweepstakes.
Yeah.
A 12-speed bicycle.
This comic could be worth $25,000.
Yeah. So anyways, I just noticed that on this one that they took out the bold and the red.
Yeah.
I was like, that's
weird. It has to match.
The things that you guys notice and bothers you and it's so funny.
Oh, it doesn't bother me.
Not this
one. I like how the X-Men books are all designed like that. So yeah, because their text at the top where they show all the creators has to match the text anywhere else, either on the bottom or on the side.
Yeah, and I just think that's a cool, they get their own different font and different rules for how they do the cover and everything. Because when you see these things, like sometimes I do look at what books are coming out if I'm going to the store right then. And so I go to the Marvel website, and they never have any. Like, they just have the generic.
Why would you go to the Marvel website? Why wouldn't you go to Comics List?
Just let them go to them.
Marvel... Marvel says what comics they're putting out that week.
I hope they update that. That's the thing I would wonder.
I hope you're not getting wrong information.
because there's light books and everything like that. So I'm thinking, I hope that someone's updating it. It's not just a listing from like what was supposed to come out a few months ago.
I know, maybe it doesn't get updated. I'm not going to say that I know for sure, but I just go to their website and they list what books are coming out that week. And that's how I know. But they never have the corner box stuff. So I always, that's when I show up and get to see what the actual covers look like. Because they just have the little Marvel symbol on them.
Sure.
And I don't know why. I guess they don't want people scanning the UPC or whatever.
They don't have the full cover dress on it yet.
Oh, yeah, you're right. They don't. All those X-Men ones have that. Because I'm looking at my other X-Men ones. I guess I never noticed till I had them next to each other that it didn't. But my problem with that is I didn't realize that they were doing that thing where they're all in series. And I don't know that I want to buy all the comics. So I'm slightly concerned that Rogue and Gambit isn't going to be standalone-y enough. Oh. If you open the back, it has that list of like, what's the next one? The next one.
Oh, yeah, they do.
You know what the biggest...
Not.
You know what the biggest secret about that checklist is, though? I found out that when they do the collections and everything like that, that checklist isn't a reading order.
No.
Okay, because I might...
And I didn't
follow
it anyway, so once... And I made my own reading order. So once they confirmed it wasn't a reading order, I was like, yes, vindicated all this time.
Once those Death of Wolverine things started and it was like, this doesn't fit in like that, I realized this is all wrong.
Yeah,
and
so
I'm free
just didn't
now.
Want...
It freed me.
It freed you.
Yep.
Well, I was a little bit...
I'm outside of time.
Because I had taken a break from a lot of the X-Men stuff, so I was like, I hope that... Because I didn't mind when Hickman started and they were doing that, but I don't want to buy every single title anymore. Like,
yeah.
So, but yeah, the first issue was fun, you know? But I was like, oh no, is this going to be... Do I have to get X-Force 38 and New Mutants Lethal Legion Nightcrawlers too? And I'm like, if so, I am out.
Just take a Prozac and relax.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sit by the fire.
And I also picked up the Betsy Braddock Captain Britain number one as well, because I was like, I want to find
my
out
books, Andrew.
The exactly. Sun is setting. Well, I knew those are yours.
The sun is setting on a warm summer night.
Kevin's book, so I'm like, I gotta buy these. I gotta find out what's going on with formerly ninja Betsy Braddock.
Formerly ninja.
Yeah, she was a ninja.
It wasn't her. It was Kumon or whatever.
Oh, Kumon, Steve. Now you're coming on.
Yeah.
And on that note, let's call it a podcasting day. My thanks as always to Andrew and Kevin, and to our friends at the TVA as well. Tune in next time for more makeshift mischief and merriment in a mighty Marvel Mac. Until Gambit overcharges his credit card, make mine Marvel. Later.